Roya's statistics over that period were also similar to Jose Vidro, an undistinguished second baseman for the Montreal Expos. These differences can be especially dramatic for minor league players. In 2009, when Pakoda identified the top comparables for Jason Hayward, then a 19-year-old prospect in the Atlanta Braves system, you could find everything from Hall of Famer to murder victim. Chipper Jones, Hayward's number two comparable, is an example of the former case. One of the greatest Atlanta Braves ever, he's played 17 seasons with the club and is a lifetime 304 hitter with more than 450 home runs. On the other hand, there was Durnell Stenson, a promising prospect whose numbers were also similar to Hayward's. After playing in a developmental league game in Arizona in 2003, he was tied up, shot, and run over with his own SUV in an apparently random act of violence. All of Hayward's comparables were big, strong, multi-talented athletes who were high draft picks and displayed precocious skills in the minor leagues. But they met radically different fortunes. Bakota's innovation was to acknowledge this by providing a range of possible outcomes for each player, based on the precedents set by his comparables. Essentially, best case, worst case, and most likely scenarios. An endless array of outcomes can and will happen when we are trying to predict human performance. So far, things have been up and down for Hayward. After a terrific 2009 in which he was named the Minor League Player of the Year, he hit 8 home runs in his first 30 major league games upon making his debut with the Braves in 2010 and made the All-Star team, exceeding all expectations. His sophomore season in 2011 was rougher, however, and he hit just .227. A good statistical forecasting system might have found some reason to be optimistic after Hayward's 2011 season. His numbers were essentially the same except for his batting average. And batting average is subject to more luck than other statistics. But can statistics tell you everything you want to know about a player? 10 years ago, that was the hottest topic in baseball. Can't we all just get along? A slipshod but nevertheless commonplace reading of Moneyball is that it was a story about the conflict between two rival gangs, statheads and scouts, that centered on the different paradigms that each group had adopted to evaluate player performance. Statistics, of course, for the statheads and tools for the scouts. In 2003, when Moneyball was published, Michael Lewis's readers would not have been wrong to pick up on some animosity between the two groups. The book itself probably contributed to some of the hostility. When I attended baseball's winter meetings that year at the New Orleans Marriott, it was like being back in high school. On one side were the jocks, who, like water buffaloes at an oasis, could sometimes be found sipping whiskey and exchanging old war stories at the hotel bar. More often, they sequestered themselves in their hotel rooms to negotiate trades with one another. These were the baseball lifers, mostly in their 40s and 50s, many of them former athletes. They had paid their dues and gradually worked their way up through the organizational hierarchy. On the other side were the nerds, herds of 20 and 30-somethings armed with laptop bags and color-printed position papers, doing lap after lap around the lobby hoping to pin down a jock and beg him for a job. There wasn't much interaction between the two camps, and each side regarded the other as arrogant and closed-minded. The real source of conflict may simply have been that the jocks perceived the nerds as threats to their jobs, usually citing real or perceived cuts in scouting budgets as their evidence. It is adversarial right now, Eddie Bain, the scouting director of the Anaheim Angels, told Baseball America in a contentious roundtable at the conference that focused on Moneyball. Some of our old-time guys are losing jobs that we didn't feel they should be losing. Maybe the cutbacks were due to money or whatever, but we correlate it to the fact that some of the computer stuff is causing that, and we resent it. How many teams had really cut their scouting budgets is unclear. The Toronto Blue Jays were one team that did so, and they paid the price for it, with a series of poor drafts between 2002 and 2005. But the budget cuts were forced by the peculiarities of their corporate parent, Rogers Communications, which was struggling with a weak Canadian dollar, and not the whim of their then-general manager, the Bean disciple, J.P. Ricciardi. It's now been a decade since the publication of Moneyball, however, and these brush fires have long since burned themselves out. The success of the Red Sox, who won their first World Series title in 86 years in 2004, with a fusion approach that emphasized both statistics and scouting, may have been a key factor in the détente. Organizations that would have been classified as scouting organizations in 2003, like the St. Louis Cardinals, have since adopted a more analytic approach and are now among the most innovative in the sport. Stathead teams like the Oakland A's have expanded rather than contracted their scouting budgets. The economic recession of 2007 through 2009 may have further encouraged the use of analytic methods. Although baseball weathered the recession fairly well, suddenly everyone had become a moneyball team, needing to make the best use possible of constrained budgets. There was no shortage of cheap stathead labor. Economics and computer science graduates from Harvard and Yale, who might otherwise have planned on a $400,000 a year job at an investment bank, were willing to move to Tampa or Cleveland to work around the clock for one-tenth of that salary. The $40,000 nerd was a better investment than a $40 million free agent who was doomed to see his performance revert to the mean. It has not, however, been a unilateral victory for the statheads. If the statheads have proved their worth, so have the scouts. Pecota versus scouts. Scouts win. Pecota originally stood for Pitcher Empirical Comparison and Optimization Test Algorithm, a clunky acronym that was designed to spell out the name of Bill Pecota, a marginal infielder with the Kansas City Royals during the 1980s, who was nevertheless a constant thorn in the side of my favorite Detroit Tigers. The program had initially been built to project the performance of pitchers rather than hitters. The performance of pitchers is notoriously hard to predict, so much so that after experimenting for a couple of years with a system called WFG, you can guess what the acronym stands for, Baseball Prospectus had given up and left their prediction lines blank. I sensed an opportunity and pitched Pecota to Huckabee. Somewhat to my surprise, he and the Baseball Prospectus crew were persuaded by it. They offered to purchase Pecota for me in exchange for stock in Baseball Prospectus on the condition that I developed a similar system for hitters. I did so, and the first set of Pecota projections were published in the next winter in Baseball Prospectus 2003. When the 2003 season was over, we discovered that Pecota had performed a little better than the other commercial forecasting systems. Indeed, each year from 2003 through 2008, the system matched or bettered the competition every time that we or others tested it, while also beating the Vegas over-under lines. There were also some fortuitous successes that boosted the system's reputation. In 2007, for instance, Pecota predicted that the Chicago White Sox, just 2 years removed from winning a World Series title, would finish instead with just 72 wins. The forecast was met with howls of protest from the Chicago media and from the White Sox front office. But it turned out to be exactly right. The White Sox went 72-90. By 2009 or so, however, the other systems were catching up and sometimes beating Pecota. As I had borrowed from James and Huckabee, other researchers had borrowed some of Pecota's innovations while adding new wrinkles of their own. Some of these systems are very good. When you rank the best forecasts each year in terms of how well they predict the performance of major league players, the more advanced ones will now usually come within a percentage point or two from one another. I'd long been interested in another goal for Pecota, however, projecting the performance of minor league players like Pedroia. This is potentially much harder, and because few other systems were doing it until recently, the only real competition was the scouts. In 2006, I published a list of Pecota's top 100 prospects for the first time, comparing the rankings against the scouting-based list published at the same time by Baseball America. The players in the Pecota list were ranked by how much value they were expected to contribute over the next 6 seasons once they matriculated to the major leagues. The 2011 season marked the sixth year since the forecasts were issued, so I was finally able to open up the time capsule and see how well they performed. Although the players on this list are still fairly young, we should have a pretty good idea by now of whether they are stars, benchwarmers, or burnouts. This list did have Pedroia ranked as the fourth best prospect in baseball, and there were other successes for Pecota. The system thought highly of the prospect Ian Kinsler, whom Baseball America did not have ranked at all. He has since made two All-Star teams and has become one of the cogs in the Texas Rangers offense. Pecota liked Matt Kemp, the Dodgers superstar who nearly won baseball's elusive Triple Crown in 2011, better than Baseball America did. But have you ever heard of Joel Guzman, Donald Murphy, Zmero Petit? Unless you are a baseball junkie, probably not. Pecota liked those players as well. Baseball America also had its share of misses. The scouts were much too optimistic about Brandon Wood, Lasting's Millage, and Mark Rogers. But they seemed to have a few more hits. They identified stars like the Boston Red Sox pitcher John Lester, the Rockies shortstop Troy Tulowitzki, and the Baltimore Orioles outfielder Nick Markakis, all of whom had middling minor league statistics and whom Pecota had not ranked at all. There is enough data to compare the system statistically. Specifically, we can look at the number of wins the players on each list generated for their major league teams in the form of a statistic called Wins Above Replacement Player, or WARP, which is meant to capture all the ways that a player contributes value on the baseball diamond, hitting, pitching, and defense. The players in the Pecota list had generated 546 wins for their major league teams through 2011. But the players in Baseball America's list did better, producing 630 wins. Although the scouts' judgment is sometimes flawed, they were adding plenty of value. Their forecasts were about 15% better than ones that relied on statistics alone. That might not sound like a big difference, but it really adds up. Baseball teams are willing to pay about $4 million per win on the free agent market. The extra wins the scouts identified were thus worth a total of $336 million over this period. The biases of scouts and stat heads. Although it would have been cool if the Pecota list had gotten the better of the scouts, I didn't expect it to happen. As I wrote shortly after the lists were published, as much fun as it is to play up the scouts versus stats angle, I don't expect the Pecota rankings to be as accurate as the rankings you might get from Baseball America. The fuel of any ranking system is information, and being able to look at both scouting and statistical information means that you have more fuel. The only way that a purely stat-based prospect list should be able to beat a hybrid list is if the biases introduced by the process are so strong that they overwhelm the benefit. In other words, scouts use a hybrid approach. They have access to more information than statistics alone. Both the scouts and Pecota can look at what a player's batting average or ERA was. An unbiased system like Pecota is probably a little better at removing some of the noise from those numbers and placing them into context. Scouts, however, have access to a lot of information that Pecota has no idea about. Rather than having to infer how hard a pitcher throws from his strikeout total, for instance, they can take out their radar guns and time his fastball velocity. Or they can use their stopwatches to see how fast he runs the bases. This type of information gets one step closer to the root causes of what we are trying to predict. In the minors, a pitcher with a weak fastball can rack up a lot of strikeouts just by finding the strike zone and mixing up his pitches. Most of the hitters he is facing aren't much good, so you may as well challenge them. In the major leagues, where the batters are capable of hitting even a 98-mile-per-hour fastball out of the park, the odds are against the soft tosser. Pecota will be fooled by these false positives, while a good scout will not be. Conversely, a scout may be able to identify players who have major league talent, but who have yet to harness it. To be sure, whenever human judgment is involved, it also introduces the potential for bias. As we saw in Chapter 2, more information actually can make matters worse for people who take the wrong attitude toward prediction and use it as an excuse to advance a partisan theory about the way the world is supposed to work. instead of trying to get at the truth. Perhaps in the pre-Moneyball era, these biases were getting the better of the scouts. They may have been more concerned about the aesthetics of a player. Did he fill out his uniform in the right way? Than about his talent. If recent Baseball America lists have been very good, the ones from the early 1990s were full of notorious busts. Highly touted prospects like Todd Van Poppel, Ruben Rivera, and Brian Taylor, who never amounted to much. But stat heads can have their biases too. One of the most pernicious ones is to assume that if something cannot easily be quantified, it does not matter. In baseball, for instance, defense has long been much harder to measure than batting or pitching. In the mid-1990s, Beane's Oakland A's teams placed little emphasis on defense, and their outfield was manned by slow and bulky players like Matt Stairs, who came out of the womb as designated hitters. As analysis of defense advanced, it became apparent that the A's defective defense was costing them as many as 8 to 10 wins per season, effectively taking them out of contention no matter how good their batting statistics were. Beane got the memo, and his more recent and successful teams have had relatively good defenses. These blind spots can extract an even larger price when it comes to forecasting the performance of minor league players. With an established major league player, the question is essentially whether he can continue to perform as he has in the past. An especially clever statistical forecasting system might be able to divine an upward or downward trend of a few percentage points. But if you simply assume that the player will do about as well next season as he has in his past couple, you won't be too far off. Most likely, his future capability will not differ that much from his present output. Baseball is unique among the major professional sports, however, for its extremely deep minor league system. Whereas the National Football League has no officially sanctioned minor league, and the NBA has just a few minor league teams, baseball has 240, 8 for each major league parent. Moreover, whereas baseball or football players can jump from college or even high school straight into the pros and be impact players immediately upon arrival, this kind of instant stardom is extremely rare in baseball. Even the most talented draft picks may have to bide their time in Billings or Bakersfield or Binghamton before advancing to the major leagues. It is very challenging to predict the performance of these players because we are hoping that they will eventually be able to do something that they are not capable of at present. Perform at a high level in the major leagues. Save for a literal once-in-a-generation prospect like Bryce Harper, the best high school hitter in the country would get killed if he had to face off against major league pitching. He will have to get bigger, stronger, smarter, and more disciplined in order to play in the majors, all of which will require some combination of hard work and good fortune. Imagine if you walked into an average high school classroom, got to observe the students for a few days, and were asked to predict which of them would become doctors, lawyers, and entrepreneurs, and which ones would struggle to make ends meet. I suppose you could look at their grades and stat scores and who seemed to have more friends, but you'd have to make some pretty wild guesses. And yet amateur scouts, and any statistical system designed to emulate them, are expected to do exactly this. Although some baseball players are drafted out of college, many others come straight from high school, and the scouting process can begin when they're as young as their mid-teens. Like any group of young men, these players will be full of hormones and post-adolescent angst, still growing into their bodies, dealing with the temptations of booze and the opposite sex. Imagine if you had to entrust the future of your business to a set of entitled 19-year-olds. Beyond the Five Tools. As Lewis described in Moneyball, Billy Beane was one of those players who had prodigious talent but failed to realize it. A first-round draft pick in 1980, he played just 148 games in the majors and hit .219 for his career. Beane had a Hall of Fame career, however, compared with prospects like John Sanders, who is now a scout for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Sanders once played in the major leagues. Exactly once. Like Moonlight Graham from Field of Dreams. On April 13th, 1965, when Sanders was 19, The Kansas City Athletics used him as a pinch runner in the seventh inning of a game against the Detroit Tigers. Sanders didn't so much as advance a base. The last two hitters popped out, and he was replaced before the next inning began. He would never play in the majors again. Sanders did not lack talent. He had been a multi-sport star at Grand Island High School in Nebraska. All-state quarterback in 1963, all-state basketball in 1964, a gold medal winner in the discus at the state track meet. Baseball might not even have been his best sport, but he was darned good at it. And when he graduated in the summer of 1964, he had a professional contract from the A's to accompany his diploma. But Sanders' development was stymied by something called the bonus baby rule. Before the introduction of the Major League Draft in 1965, all amateur players were free agents, and teams could pay them whatever they wanted. To prevent the wealthiest teams from hoarding the talent, the rule extracted a punishment. Players who received a large signing bonus were required to spend their first two professional seasons on the Major League roster, even though they were nowhere near ready to play at that level. The rule really punished bright prospects like Sanders. Most of the bonus babies spent their time riding the bench, rarely seeing any big league action. They were shut out from getting everyday game experience at the very time they needed it the most. Fans and teammates, wondering why some peach-fuzzed 19-year-old was being paid thousands to be a glorified bat boy, were unlikely to be sympathetic to their plight. Although a few bonus babies like Sandy Koufax and Harmon Killebrew went on to have Hall of Fame careers, many other talented prospects of the era never overcame the experience. Sanders' background, going from perhaps the best amateur athlete in the state of Nebraska to a footnote in the baseball encyclopedia, gives him unique insight into the psyches of young players. I caught up with him by cell phone one morning while he was driving from North Carolina to Georgia to watch the Braves' top affiliate play. At the 2003 winter meetings in New Orleans, I would have pegged Sanders as one of the jocks. He devoted his life to the sport after his brief playing career ended. But Sanders has never seen the game through the jocks versus nerds prism. "I love to evaluate," he told me. "I've always enjoyed statistical proofs, even way back in the day, when we did it with calculators and adding machines." Sanders relayed an anecdote. One of the scouts said, "Well, let's face it, guys. What's the first thing we do when we go to the ballpark? We go to the press room. We get the stats." "We get the stats? What's wrong with that?" "That's what you do." Statistics, indeed, have been a part of the fabric of baseball since the very beginning. The first newspaper box score, which included five categories of statistics for each player, runs, hits, putouts, assists, and errors, was published by Henry Chadwick in 1859, 12 years before the first professional league was established in 1871. Many of the Moneyball-era debates concerned not whether statistics should be used, but which ones should be taken into account. On-base percentage, OBP, for instance, as analysts like James had been pointing out for years, is more highly correlated with scoring runs and winning games than batting average, a finding which long went underappreciated by traditionalists within the industry. This type of debate was usually fought on the stat head's turf. That OBP conveys more useful information than batting average, or that a pitcher's ERA is a fairer indicator of his performance than his win-loss record, are scientific facts, as much as the Earth's revolution around the sun. The stat heads were unambiguously right about them. But being on the winning side of these arguments may have led the stat head community to be complacent or dismissive about other points on which there is much more ambiguity. The further you get away from the majors, the more you are trying to predict a player's performance instead of measure it, the less useful statistics are. Statistics at the more advanced minor league levels, like AA and AAA, have been shown to be almost as predictive as major league numbers. But statistics at the lower minor league levels are less reliable, and the numbers for college or high school players have very little predictive power. The scout's traditional alternative to statistics are the five tools: hitting for power, hitting for average, speed, arm strength, and defensive range. It is a list that has drawn, and deserves, much criticism. Plate discipline, which consists of drawing walks and avoiding strikeouts, is not represented. And the invocation of the five tools sometimes conveys the impression that they are all equally important, when in fact hitting for power is far more important than arm strength at all positions, save for shortstop and catcher. There is also reason to think that the five tools alone won't tell us very much. As a player works his way up the minor league ladder, the tools should increasingly be reflected in the player's statistics, or he probably isn't bound to advance any higher. Some of the categories, in fact, essentially are statistics. Hitting for average is expressed by a player's batting average. Hitting for power, by doubles and home runs. If a scout tells you that a certain player grades out at a 70 on the 80-point scouting scale in the hitting for power category, but he's struggling to hit 10 home runs per year for the Altoona curve, how much faith would you really put in the scouting report? Sanders, the industry veteran, is skeptical of the emphasis placed on the five tools. The impact toolbox is obvious to anyone. Runs fast, throws hard, all that stuff. Scouts can walk in and see those immediately, he told me. I think the question is, are those skills used effectively to make for winning ballplayers? Are those tools converted into usable skills? Bat speed, we can see that fairly quickly. But if the person has bat speed, but he doesn't trust it, if he's always jumping out at pitches, that's not usable. Sanders' focus is less on physical tools and more on usable, game-ready skills. The extent to which one can be translated to the other depends on what he calls a player's mental toolbox. The mental tools are often slower to develop than the physical ones. Sanders' wife is a special needs educator and pointed him toward research suggesting that most of us are still in a state of mental adolescence until about the age of 24. Before that age, Sanders will cut a player some slack if he sees signs that their mental tools are developing. After that, he needs to see performance. Interestingly, 24 is right about the age when a player is usually in AA and his performance starts to become more predictable from his statistics. Sanders has no formal definition of what a player's mental toolbox should include. But over the course of our conversation, I identified five different intellectual and psychological abilities that he believes help to predict success at the major league level. Preparedness and work ethic. Baseball is unlike almost all other professional sports, in that games are played 6 or 7 times a week. A baseball player can't get amped up for a game day, as a football or basketball player might. He has to be ready to perform at a professional level every day. This means he must have a certain amount of discipline. Sanders likes to get to the ballpark early, because he contends he can better detect this attribute in a player's pregame rituals than during the game itself. Pedroia, for instance, was clearly more focused than his teammates during infield practice that September night at Fenway Park. He had his routine, and he wasn't putting up with any distractions, and certainly not some reporter he'd never heard of trying to interview him. Concentration and focus. Although related to preparedness, this category specifically concerns the manner in which a player conducts himself during the course of the game. Baseball is a reflex sport. A hitter has about 0.3 seconds to decide whether to swing at a pitch. An infielder has to react to a sharply hit grounder as soon as it comes off the bat. If a player is not energized, I don't know what we can do with them, Sanders says. I want a shortstop, a middle infielder, to have pitch-by-pitch focus that's off the charts. Competitiveness and self-confidence. While it may seem like a given that any professional athlete would be a natural-born competitor, baseball players must overcome self-doubt and other psychological obstacles in the early stages of their careers. One moment they were the king of the hill in high school. The next, they are riding buses between Kannapolis and Greensboro, reading about their failures on the internet each time they go into a slump. When Sanders sees a talented player underachieving, he wonders, is there a desire to succeed to the degree that there's a failure mechanism kicking in? Is there a fear of failure? Is the desire to succeed significant enough to overcome the fear of failure? Stress management and humility. In baseball, even the best hitters fail a majority of the time, and every player will enter a slump at certain points during the season. The ability to cope with this failure requires a short memory and a certain sense of humor. One of Sanders' favorite scouting tactics is to observe how a player reacts after a rough or unlucky play. I like to see a hitter when he flails at a pitch, when he takes a big swing, and to the fans it looks ridiculous. I like to look down and see a smile on his face. And then the next time, bam, 400 feet. These skills will only become more critical once a player reaches the majors and has to deal with scrutiny from fans and the media. Adaptiveness and learning ability. How successfully is the player able to process new information during a game? Listen to advice from his coaches. How does he adapt when his life situation changes? What if he's traded or asked to play a new position? The path between amateur ball and the major leagues is rarely linear, even for the most talented prospects. And so a great player can't be too rigid in his mental approach. Players who are successful at this game are people who, when they walk down the hall of the building and there's a turn, they make a round turn. They don't make a sharp turn, Sanders observes. It's a controlled intensity. These same habits, of course, are important in many human endeavors. Some of them even have applications for forecasters, especially the one Sanders calls adaptiveness. How do you react to new information when it comes your way? Being too hot under the collar and overreacting to a change in the circumstances, or being too cool to change your mind when the evidence dictates otherwise, will lead to bad predictions. Few professions, however, are as competitive as baseball. Among the thousands of professional baseball players and the hundreds of thousands of amateurs, only 750 are able to play in the major leagues at any given time, and only a few dozen of those will be all-stars. Sanders' job is to search for those exceptional individuals who defy the odds. He has to work nearly as hard at his job as the players do, and he is still out on the road almost every day in his late 60s. But the payoff provides Sanders and the Dodgers with the most valuable kind of information. The kind of information that other people don't have. Information is the name of the game. Billy Beane, the protagonist of Moneyball, sees relentless information gathering as the secret to good scouting. What defines a good scout? Finding out information that other people can't, he told me. Getting to know the kid, getting to know the family. There's just some things that you have to find out in person. Beane should know. Much of the success of the A's was a result of the team's statistical aptitude. But their scouting of amateur players was just as critical to their achievements. Most of the team's stars during the early 2000s period that Moneyball chronicled, Miguel Tejada, Jason Giambi, Barry Zito, Tim Hudson, Eric Chavez, had been signed and developed by the club. Beane told me the A's scouting budget is now much higher than it has ever been. Moreover, he said it was the A's fascination with statistical analysis that led them to increase it. As we've seen, baseball players do not become free agents until after 6 full seasons, which is usually not until they're at least 30. As Bill James' analysis of the aging curve revealed, this often leads clubs to overspend on free agents. After all, their best years are usually behind them. But there's a flip side to this. Before a player is 30, he can provide tremendous value to his club. Moreover, baseball's economics are structured such that younger players can often be had for pennies on the dollar. If a baseball team is viewed, as with any other business, from a standpoint of profits and losses, almost all the value is created by the scouting and development process. If a team's forecasting system is exceptionally good, perhaps it can pay $10 million a year for a player whose real value is $12 million. But if its scouting is really good, it might be paying the same player just $400,000. That is how you compete in a small market like Oakland. So the A's have no lack of respect for the role of scouting. Quite the contrary. Nor, being made clear, do they shy away from looking at a player's mental makeup when deciding which ones to bring into their organization. the organization still very much believes in rigorous analysis. The rigor and discipline is applied, however, in the way the organization processes the information it collects, and not in declaring certain types of information off-limits. The proportion of objective versus subjective analysis is weighted more in some organizations than in others, he explained. From our standpoint in Oakland, we're sort of forced into making objective decisions versus gut-feel decisions. If we in Oakland happen to be right on a gut-feel decision one time, my guess is it would be random. And we're not in a position to be making random decisions and hope we get lucky. If we're playing blackjack and the dealer is showing a 4 and we have a 6, hitting on the 16 just doesn't make sense for us. The key to making a good forecast, as we observed in Chapter 2, is not in limiting yourself to quantitative information. Rather, it's having a good process for weighing the information appropriately. This is the essence of Bean's philosophy. Collect as much information as possible, but then be as rigorous and disciplined as possible when analyzing it. The litmus test for whether you are a competent forecaster is if more information makes your predictions better. If you're screwing it up, you have some bad habits and attitudes, like Phil Tetlock's political pundits did. If Prospect Day is hitting 300 with 20 home runs and works at a soup kitchen during his off days, and Prospect B is hitting 300 with 20 home runs but hits up nightclubs and snorts coke during his free time, there's probably no way to quantify this distinction. But you'd sure as hell want to take it into account. Many times, in fact, it is possible to translate qualitative information into quantitative information. Scouts actually do rate players using a hard numerical scale, which ranges from 20 to 80 in each category. There's no reason you couldn't place that into a statistical model alongside a player's batting average and see where it adds value. Some teams, like the Cardinals, already attempt versions of this. Indeed, the line between stats and scouting and qualitative and quantitative information has become very blurry in the baseball industry. Take, for example, the introduction of PitchFX, a system of three-dimensional cameras that have now been installed at every major league stadium. PitchFX can measure not just how fast a pitch travels, that has been possible for years with radar guns, but how much it moves horizontally and vertically before reaching the plate. We can now say statistically, for instance, that Zach Greinke, a young pitcher with the Milwaukee Brewers who won the 2009 Cy Young Award as his league's best pitcher, has baseball's best slider, or that Mariano Rivera's cut fastball is really as good as reputed. Traditionally, these things were considered to be in the domain of scouting. Now they're another variable that can be placed into a projection system. We're not far from a point where we might have a complete three-dimensional recording of everything that takes place on a baseball field. We'll soon be able to measure exactly how good a jump Jacoby Ellsberg gets on a fly ball hit over his head. We'll know exactly how fast Ichiro Suzuki rounds the bases, or exactly how quickly Yadier Molina gets the ball down to second base when he's trying to throw out an opposing base stealer. This new technology will not kill scouting any more than Moneyball did, but it may change its emphasis toward the things that are even harder to quantify and where the information is more exclusive, like a player's mental tools. Smart scouts like Sanders are already ahead of the curve. Why Pedroia was predicted to fail. But why were the scouts so wrong about Dustin Pedroia? All the scouts were in agreement on the basic facts about him. Everyone knew that Pedroia was a very good hitter for average, that he had a smart approach at the plate, and that his mental toolbox was off the charts. Everyone knew that he had a long swing, that his defense was steady but unspectacular, that his foot speed was no better than average, that he was short and did not have a terrific physique. It was an idiosyncratic profile for a young player, however, and a lot of scouts didn't know what to make of it. When you draw up a player, scouts have a feel for what they want to see, Sanders told me. Prototypical standards. Dustin went against the grain in some of those areas, starting with his size. When we can't fit a square peg into a round hole, we usually blame the peg, when sometimes it's the rigidity of our thinking that accounts for our failures to accommodate it. Our first instinct is to place information into categories, usually a relatively small number of categories, since they'll be easier to keep track of. Think of how the Census Bureau classifies people from hundreds of ethnic groups into just 6 racial categories, or how thousands of artists are placed into a taxonomy of a few musical genres. This might work well enough most of the time, but when we have trouble categorizing something, we'll often overlook it or misjudge it. This is one of the reasons that Bean avoids what he calls gut-feel decisions. If he relies too heavily on his first impressions, he'll let potentially valuable prospects slip through the cracks, and he can't afford that with a payroll like Oakland's. A system like Pocota, which searches through thousands of players to find the ones with similar profiles, has a more rigorous way to categorize players. It could place Pedroia's skills more within their proper context. Pocota's search found some favorable precedents. Pedroia's short stature, for example, may actually have been an advantage given the rest of his skills. In baseball, the strike zone is defined as running from a player's shoulders to his knees. The smaller the athlete, the smaller the target the pitcher gets to throw at. A player like Pedroia, with a good batting eye, can take a special advantage of this. Meanwhile, being lower to the ground can be an asset to a second baseman's defense. It's a position that relies on agility, having cat-like reflexes to ground balls that come hot off the bat. Many of the best second basemen in baseball history have been very short. Of the 17 in the Hall of Fame, only 2, Knapp Lajoie and Ryne Sandberg, were over 6 feet tall. Joe Morgan, perhaps the greatest second baseman of all time, was just 5'7". Scouts are very good at what they do, but this is a case where they had categorized a player too quickly and too prejudicially. Pedroia's diminutive stature was in some ways a strength. Still, there were no guarantees. Pocota had not seen Pedroia's success as certain, just that the odds were in his favor. The scouts saw the odds as weighted against him. What made the difference is that the Red Sox believed in Dustin Pedroia. And fortunately for the Red Sox, Pedroia believed in Pedroia too. And how he beat the odds. I met Bill James for the first time on a panel at the New Yorker Festival in October 2009. There was a fancy party afterward, and he looked out of place among the fashionistas, wearing an exceedingly colorful sweater and a pair of scuff-marked clogs that looked like they were 2 sizes too big. While everyone else at the party was chasing down Susan Sarandon, we parked ourselves at the bar and chatted for a while. James's responsibilities with the Red Sox are varied and kept close to the vest. He wasn't able to go into much detail about them on the record. But after having spent a quarter century writing on baseball as an outside agitator, he's mellowed into late adulthood. The sport looks a little different to him now that he is on the inside. He is quicker to recognize the mental aspects of the game. "There are a lot of things I wrote in the 80s that weren't right," he told me. "The big change was my having children. I know it's a cliche, but once you have children, you start to understand that everyone is somebody's baby. It's an insider's-outsider's thing. You grow up and these people are characters on TV or video games or baseball cards. You don't really think about the fact that these guys are humans and doing the best they can." I was struck by how similar many of James's comments were to those of Bean and Sanders, even though they traditionally have approached the sport from very different angles. Indeed, if you put the transcripts of my conversations with James, Bean, and Sanders into a lineup, you would scarcely be able to pick them out, except that James's would be much funnier. He comes to recognize the value that the Red Sox scouts provide to the club, and believes that it's parallel to his own mission. In baseball, success is measured in a very particular way, by W's and L's. So it's easy to keep everyone on the right track. If more information is making your predictions worse, you'll be out of a job. Not entitled to a lifetime appointment to the McLaughlin Group. On a certain level, the way that I see baseball and the way scouts see baseball is pretty similar, James continued. Maybe it's one of those things where if you go far enough to the right and far enough to the left on the political spectrum, you find people saying the exact same thing. What scouts are trying to see is really the same thing that I am trying to see. James was assisting with the Red Sox draft process in 2004 when they took Pedroia with the 65th pick. He had written a favorable report on Pedroia, but recommended that they draft someone else. Nevertheless, he was pleased with the selection, and has enjoyed watching Pedroia make his critics look foolish. There were a few moments early in his career, however, when even some of Pedroia's biggest fans were starting to have their doubts. Pedroia was first called up to the big leagues in August 2006, playing in 31 games, but compiling just a .198 batting average and just 6 extra base hits. Nobody was too concerned about this. The Red Sox, unusually for them, were well out of playoff contention in the final weeks of the season, and New England's attention was already turning to the Celtics and the Patriots. But the next year, entrusted with a full-time second base job, he started out slowly as well. His batting average just .172 after the first month of the season. A team like the Cubs, who until recently were notorious for their haphazard decision-making process, might have cut Pedroia at this point. For many clubs, every action is met by an equal and opposite overreaction. The Red Sox, on the other hand, are disciplined by their more systematic approach. And when the Red Sox looked at Pedroia at that point in the season, James told me they actually saw a lot to like. Pedroia was making plenty of contact with the baseball. It just hadn't been falling for hits. The numbers most likely would start to trend his way. "We all have moments of losing confidence in the data," James told me. "You probably know this, but if you look back at the previous year, when Dustin hit .180 or something, if you go back and look at his swing and miss percentage, it was maybe about 8%, maybe 9%. It was the same during that period in the spring when he was struggling. It was always logically apparent. When you swing as hard as he does, there's no way in the world that you can make that much contact and keep hitting .180. The Red Sox hadn't taken their decision to draft Pedroia lightly. They were still observing him do the same things that had made him successful at every other amateur and professional level. If they were going to bench Pedroia, the decision would have to be just as carefully considered as the one to promote him in the first place. They did not let the data dictate their decision without placing it in a larger context. Their only concern, James told me, was whether Pedroia would start to doubt himself. And another player might have, but not Pedroia, who suffers neither fools nor critics. Fortunately, Dustin is really cocky. Because if he was the kind of person who was intimidated, if he had listened to those people, it would have ruined him. He didn't listen to people. He continued to dig in and swing from his heels, and eventually things turned around for him. Pedroia has what John Sanders calls a major league memory, which is to say, a short one. He isn't troubled by a slump, because he is damn sure that he's playing the game the right way, and in the long run, that's what matters. Indeed, he has very little tolerance for anything that distracts him from doing his job. This doesn't make him the most generous human being, but it is exactly what he needs in order to play second base for the Boston Red Sox, and that's the only thing that Pedroia cares about. "Our weaknesses and our strengths are always very intimately connected," James said. Pedroia made strengths out of things that would be weaknesses for other players. The real lessons of Moneyball. As Michael Lewis said, "The debate is over," Billy Beane declared when we were discussing Moneyball. For a time, Moneyball was very threatening to people in the game. It seemed to imply that their jobs and livelihoods were at stake. But the reckoning never came. Scouts were never replaced by computers. In fact, the demand to know what the future holds for different types of baseball players, whether couched in terms of scouting reports or statistical systems like Pacoda, still greatly exceeds the supply. Millions of dollars, and the outcome of future World Series, are put at stake each time a team decides which player to draft, whom to trade for, how much they should pay for a free agent. Teams are increasingly using every tool at their disposal to make these decisions. The information revolution has lived up to its billing in baseball, even though it has been a letdown in so many other fields. Because of the sport's unique combination of rapidly developing technology, well-aligned incentives, tough competition, and rich data. This isn't necessarily making life easier for Bean, who expressed concern that the other teams have copied the A's best tricks. Very few teams, for instance, now fail to understand the importance of OBP, or neglect the role played by defense. And what hasn't changed is that those teams still have a lot more money than the A's. In the most competitive industries, like sports, the best forecasters must constantly innovate. It's easy to adopt a goal of exploit market inefficiencies, but that doesn't really give you a plan for how to find them and then determine whether they represent fresh dawns or false leads. It's hard to have an idea that nobody else has thought of. It's even harder to have a good idea. And when you do, it will soon be duplicated. That is why this book shies away from promoting quick-fix solutions that imply you can just go about your business in a slightly different way and outpredict the competition. Good innovators typically think very big, and they think very small. New ideas are sometimes found in the most granular details of a problem where few others bother to look, and they are sometimes found when you are doing your most abstract and philosophical thinking, considering why the world is the way that it is, and whether there might be an alternative to the dominant paradigm. Rarely can they be found in the temperate latitudes between these two spaces, where we spend 99% of our lives. The categorizations and approximations we make in the normal course of our lives are usually good enough to get by. But sometimes we let information that might give us a competitive advantage slip through the cracks. The key is to develop tools and habits so that you are more often looking for ideas and information in the right places and in honing the skills required to harness them into W's and L's once you've found them. It's hard work, but baseball will remain an unusually fertile proving ground for innovators. There hasn't been a really groundbreaking forecasting system since Pakoda's debut 10 years ago. But someone will come along and take advantage of pitch FX data in a smart way, or will figure out how to fuse quantitative and qualitative evaluations of player performance. All this will happen, and sooner rather than later, possibly in the time that this book is at the printer. The people who are coming into the game, the creativity, the intelligence, it's unparalleled right now, Bean told me. In 10 years, if I applied for this job, I wouldn't even get an interview. Moneyball is dead. Long live Moneyball. Chapter 4. For years you've been telling us that rain is green. On Tuesday, August 23rd, 2005, an Air Force reconnaissance plane picked up signs of a disturbance over the Bahamas. There were several small vortices, it reported. Spirals of wind rotating in a counterclockwise motion from east to west, away from the expanse of the Atlantic and toward the United States. This disruption in wind patterns was hard to detect from clouds or from satellite data, but cargo ships were beginning to recognize it. The National Hurricane Center thought there was enough evidence to characterize the disturbance as a tropical cyclone, labeling it Tropical Depression 12. It was a tricky storm that might develop into something more serious or might just as easily dissipate. About half of all tropical depressions in the Atlantic Basin eventually become hurricanes. The depression strengthened quickly, however, and by Wednesday afternoon, one of the Hurricane Center's computer models was already predicting a double landfall in the United States. The first one over southern Florida, and a second that might take the cyclone to New Orleans. The storm had gathered enough strength to become a hurricane, and it was given a name, Katrina. Katrina's first landfall, it passed just north of Miami, then zoomed through the Florida Everglades a few hours later as a Category 1 hurricane, had not been prolonged enough to threaten many lives. But it had also not been long enough to take much energy out of the storm. Instead, Katrina was gaining strength in the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. In the wee hours of Saturday morning, the forecast really took a turn for the worse. Katrina had become a Category 3 hurricane on its way to being a Category 5, and its forecast track had gradually been moving westward, away from the Florida Panhandle and toward Mississippi and Louisiana. The computer models were now in agreement. The storm seemed bound for New Orleans. "I think I had 5 congressional hearings after Katrina," said Max Mayfield, who was director of the National Hurricane Center at the time the storm hit, when I asked him to recall when he first recognized the full magnitude of the threat. "One of them asked me when I first became concerned with New Orleans. I said, 60 years ago." A direct strike of a major hurricane on New Orleans had long been every weather forecaster's worst nightmare. The city presented a perfect set of circumstances that might contribute to the death and destruction there. On the one hand, there was its geography. New Orleans does not border the Gulf of Mexico as much as sink into it. Much of the population lived below sea level and was counting on protection from an outmoded system of levees and a set of natural barriers that had literally been washing away to sea. On the other hand, there was its culture. New Orleans does many things well, but there are 2 things that it proudly refuses to do. New Orleans does not move quickly, and New Orleans does not place much faith in authority. If it did those things, New Orleans would not really be New Orleans. It would also have been much better prepared to deal with Katrina, since those are the exact 2 things you need to do when a hurricane threatens to strike. The National Hurricane Center nailed its forecast of Katrina. It anticipated a potential hit on the city almost 5 days before the levees were breached, and concluded that some version of the nightmare scenario was probable more than 48 hours away. 20 or 30 years ago, this much advance warning would almost certainly not have been possible, and fewer people would have been evacuated. The Hurricane Center's forecast and the steady advances made in weather forecasting over the past few decades undoubtedly saved many lives. Not everyone listened to the forecast, however. About 80,000 New Orleanians, almost a fifth of the city's population at the time, failed to evacuate the city, and 1,600 of them died. Surveys of the survivors found that about 2/3 of them did not think the storm would be as bad as it was. Others had been confused by a bungled evacuation order. The city's mayor, Ray Nagin, waited almost 24 hours to call for a mandatory evacuation, despite pleas from Mayfield and from other public officials. Still other residents, impoverished, elderly, or disconnected from the news, could not have fled even if they had wanted to. Weather forecasting is one of the success stories in this book, a case of man and machine joining forces to understand and sometimes anticipate the complexities of nature. That we can sometimes predict nature's course, however, does not mean we can alter it. Nor does a forecast do much good if there is no one willing to listen to it. The story of Katrina is one of human ingenuity and human error. The weather of supercomputers. The supercomputer labs at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCAR, in Boulder, Colorado, literally produce their own weather. They are hot. The 77 trillion calculations that the IBM Bluefire supercomputer makes every second generate a substantial amount of radiant energy. They are windy. All that heat must be cooled, lest the nation's ability to forecast its weather be placed into jeopardy. And so a series of high-pressure fans blast oxygen on the computers at all times. And they are noisy. The fans are loud enough that hearing protection is standard operating equipment. The Bluefire is divided into 11 cabinets, each about 8 feet tall and 2 feet wide, with a bright green racing stripe running down the side. From the back, they look about how you might expect a supercomputer to look. A mass of crossed cables and blinking blue lights feeding into the machine's brainstem. From the front, they are about the size and shape of a portable toilet, complete with what appears to be a door with a silver handle. "They look a little bit like porta-potties," I tell Dr. Richard Loft, the Director of Technology Development for NCAR, who oversees the supercomputer lab. Those in the meteorology business are used to being the butt of jokes. Larry David, in the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, posits that meteorologists sometimes predict rain when there won't be, just so that they can get a head start on everyone else at the golf course. Political commercials use weather metaphors as a basis to attack their opponents. usually to suggest that they are always flip-flopping on the issues. Most people assume that weather forecasters just aren't very good at what they do. Indeed, it was tempting to look at the rows of whirring computers and wonder if this was all an exercise in futility. All this to forecast the weather?